This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Madness Underneath by Maureen Johnson, performed by Nicola Barber. The Royal Gunpowder Pub, Artillery Lane, East London, November 11, 10:15 a.m. Charlie Strong liked his customers. You don't run a pub for 21 years if you don't like your customers, but there was something about the quiet in the morning that pleased him to no end. In the morning, Charlie had the one cigarette he allowed himself daily. He drew on the silk cut slowly, listening to the satisfying sizzle of burning paper and tobacco. He could smoke inside when no one else was here. Good mug of tea, good smoke, good bacon on his sandwich. Charlie switched on the television. The television in the Royal Gunpowder went on for only two things, when Liverpool played and Morning with Michael and Alice, the relentlessly cheerful talk show. Charlie liked to watch this as he prepared for the day, particularly the cooking part. They always made something good, and for some reason, this made him enjoy his bacon sandwich even more. Talking about some music festival that was going on in London over the weekend. This interested Charlie less than the chicken, but he watched it anyway, since he had a cigarette to finish. When he was down to the filter, he stubbed it out and got to work. He had just started wiping down the blackboard to write the day's specials when he heard the sound of breaking glass from below. He opened the basement door.
Sam, what in God's name?
Charlie, get down here.
What's the matter?
Charlie yelled back. Sam did not reply. Charlie swore under his breath, allowed himself one heavy post-smoke cough, and headed down the stairs. The basement stairs were narrow and steep, and the basement itself was full of things Charlie largely didn't want to deal with. Broken chairs and tables, heavy crates of supplies, racks of glasses ready to replace the ones that were chipped, cracked, or stolen every day.
Sam?
He called.
In here.
Sam's voice was coming from a small room off the main one. Charlie ducked down. The ceiling was lower in this room. It just skimmed his head. Many times he had almost knocked himself senseless on it. Sam was near the wall, cowering between two shelving units. There were two shattered pint glasses, as well as a roughly drawn X in chalk on the stone floor.
What are you playing at, Sam?
I didn't do that,
Sam replied.
Those weren't there a few minutes ago.
Are you feeling all right?
I'm telling you, those weren't there.
This was not good. Not good at all. The glasses clearly hadn't fallen off a shelf. They were in the middle of the room. The X was shaky, like the hand that had drawn it could barely hold the chalk. No one looked healthy in the basement's faintly greenish fluorescent light, but Sam looked particularly bad. The color had drained from his face, and he was quivering and glistening with sweat. Maybe this had been bound to happen. Charlie had always known the risks, but the risks were part of the agreement. He had gotten sober, and he trusted that others could as well, and you needed to show that trust. Charlie said quietly,
If you've been taking something, I haven't. But if you have, you just need to tell me. I swear to you,
Sam said.
I haven't.
Sam, there's no shame in it. Sobriety is a process.
I didn't take anything, and I didn't do that.
There was an urgency in Sam's voice that frightened Charlie, and he was not a man who frightened easily. He'd been through fights, withdrawal, divorce. He faced alcohol, his personal demon, every day. Yet something in this room, something in the sight of Sam huddled against the wall and this crude X and broken glass on the floor, something in this unnerved him. There was no point in checking to see if anyone else was down here. Every business in the area had fortified itself when the Ripper was around. The Royal Gunpowder was secure. Charlie bent down and ran his hand over the cool stone floor.
How about we just get rid of this?
He said. wiping away the chalked X with his hand. In cases like this, it was best to calmly get things back to normal and sit down and talk the issue through.
Come on now, we'll go upstairs and have a cup of tea, and we'll talk this out.
Sam took a few tentative steps from the wall.
Good, that's right. Now let's just get rid of this, and we'll have a nice cuppa, you and me.
Charlie continued wiping away the last of the X. He didn't see the hammer. The hammer was used to pry open crates, to knock sticky valves into action, and to do quick repairs on the often unstable shelving units. Now, it rose, lingering just long enough over Charlie's head to find its mark.
No!
Sam screamed. Charlie turned his head in time to see the hammer come down. The first time it did so, Charlie remained upright. He made a noise, not quite a word, more of a broken, gurgling sound. There was a second blow, and a third. Charlie was still upright, but twitching, struggling against the onslaught. The fourth blow seemed to do the most damage. An audible cracking sound could be heard. On that fourth blow, Charlie fell forward and did not move again. The hammer clattered to the ground. The crack in the floor. Out flew the web and floated wide. The mirror cracked from side to side. The curse has come upon me, cried the Lady of Shalott. Alfred Lord Tennyson, The Lady of Shalott. Chapter 1. Back at Wexford, where I went to school before all of this happened to me, they made me play hockey every day. I had no idea how to play hockey, so they covered me in padding and made me stand in the goal. From the goal, I could watch my fellow players run around with sticks. Occasionally, they'd whack a small, very hard ball in my direction. I would dive out of the way every time. Apparently, avoiding the ball isn't the point of hockey, and Claudia would scream, "No, Aurora, no!" from the sidelines. But I didn't care. I take my best lessons from nature, and nature says, when something flies at your head, move. I didn't think hockey had trained me for anything in life until I went to therapy. "So," Julia said. Julia was my therapist. She was Scottish and petite and had a shock of white blonde hair. She was probably in her 50s, but the lines in her face were imperceptible. She was a careful person, well-spoken, so achingly professional it actually made me itch. She didn't fuss around in her chair or need to change over and cross the other leg. She just sat there, calm as a monk. The winds might blow and the rains might fall, but Julia would remain in the same position in her ergonomic chair and wait it out. The clock in Julia's office was hidden in plain sight. She put it behind the chair where her patient sat, on top of a bookcase. I followed the clock by watching its reflection in the window, watching time run backward. I had just managed to waste a solid 45 minutes talking about my grandmother, a new record for me. But I'd run out of steam, and the silence descended on the room like a vague but ever-intensifying smell. There was a lot going on behind her never-blinking eyes. I could tell, from what now amounted to hours of staring at her, that Julia was studying me even more carefully than I was studying her. And I knew about her relationship with that clock. All she had to do was flick her eyes just a tiny bit to the left, and she could see both me and the time without moving her head. It was an incredibly small move, but I had started to look for it. When Julia checked the time, it meant she was about to do something. Flick. Time to get ready. Julia was going to make a move. The ball was heading for my face. Time to dodge.
Rory, I want you to think back for me.
Dive, dive!
We all learn about death somehow. I want you to try to remember. How did you learn?
I had to restrain myself. It doesn't look good if your therapist asks you how you learned about death and you practically jump off the couch in excitement because that's pretty much your favorite story ever. But as it happens, I have a really good learning about death story. I wasted about a full minute grinding away the airtime, tilting my head back and forth. It's hard to pretend to think. thinking doesn't have an action stance, and I suspected that my thinking face looked a lot like my I'm dizzy and may throw up face. I was 10, I guess. We went to Mrs. Haverty's house. She lived in Magnolia Hall. Magnolia Hall is this big heritage site, proper antebellum South, gone with the wind, look at how things were before the war of northern aggression sort of place. It has columns and shutters and about 100 magnolia trees. Have you ever seen Gone with the Wind?
A long time ago.
Well, it looks like that. It's where tourists go. It's on a lot of brochures. Everything about it looks like it's from 1860 or something. And no one ever sees Mrs. Haverty because she's crazy old, like maybe she was born in 1860. So an elderly woman in a historical house, she said. Right. I was in Girl Scouts. I was a really bad Girl Scout. I never got any badges and I forgot my troop number. But once a year, there was this amazing picnic thing at Magnolia Hall. Mrs. Haverty let the Girl Scouts use the grounds because apparently she had been a Girl Scout back when the rocks were young and the atmosphere was forming. Julia eyed me curiously. I shouldn't have thrown in that last little flourish. I'd told this story so many times that I'd refined it, given it nice little touches. My family loves it. I pull it out every year at our awkward get-together dinners at Big Jim's or at my grandmother's house. It's my go-to story. So, I said, slowing down, she'd have barbecue would get us off-roading again. But Julia put her hand up preemptively. She knew. So I kept quiet for a moment and discovered my real thinking face. I could see it, but I could tell it looked pained. I kept pursing and biting my lips, and the furrow between my eyes was probably deep enough to hold my phone. Can I ask you something? I finally said. Of course. Am I allowed to be fine? Of course you are. That's our goal. But it's also all right not to be fine. The simple fact of the matter is, you've had a trauma. But don't people get over traumas? They do, with help. Can't people get over traumas without help? I asked. Of course, but I'm just saying, I said more insistently. Is it possible that I'm actually okay? Do you feel okay, Rory? I just want to go back to school. You want to go back? She asked, her brogue flicking up to a particularly inquisitive point. You want to go back? Wexford leapt into my mind, like a painted backdrop on a suddenly slackened rope crashing down onto a stage. I guess we all have to lie sometimes. I was about to do the same. Yeah, I said, stretching my fingers into the tips of my gloves. Definitely. Chapter 2. I wasn't going to be able to cope with many more of these sessions. I like to talk. Talking is kind of my thing. If talking had been a sport option at Wexford, I would have been captain. But sports always have to involve running, jumping, or swinging your arms around. You don't get PE points for the smooth and rapid movement of the jaw. 3 times a week, I was sent to talk to Julia. And 3 times a week, I had to avoid talking to Julia. At least, I couldn't talk about what had really happened to me. You cannot tell your therapist you have been stabbed by a ghost. You cannot tell her that you could see the ghost because you developed the ability to see dead people after choking on some beef at dinner. If you say any of that, they will put you in a sack and take you to a room walled in bouncy rubber, and you will never be allowed to touch scissors again. The situation will only get worse if you explain to your therapist that you have friends in the secret ghost police of London, and that you are really not supposed to be talking about this because some man from the government made you sign a copy of the Official Secrets Act and touch them. This is why in my many, many hours of watching shows about ghost hunters, I'd watched a lot of television in Bristol, I'd gotten so angry. Not only were the shows stupid and obviously phony, but they didn't even make sense. These people would rock up to houses with their weird night vision camera hats and cold spot-o-meters, set up cameras, and then turn off all the lights and wait until dark, because apparently ghosts care if the lights are on or off and if it's day or night. And then these champions would fumble around in the dark saying, "If spirits are here, make yourselves known, spirits." This is roughly equivalent to a tourist bus stopping in the middle of a foreign city, and all of the tourists getting out in their funny hats with their video cameras and saying, "We are here! Dance for us, natives of this place! We wish to film you!" And of course, nothing happens. Then there's always a bump in the background, some normal creaking of a step or something, and they amplify that about 10 million times, claim they've found evidence of paranormal activity, and kick off for a cold, self-congratulatory brew. I edged around for a few minutes, taking him in from a few different angles, making sure I knew what I was looking at. I wondered what the chances were that the first time I came out and walked around Bristol on my own, I'd see a ghost. Judging from what was going on right with my arm, the inexorable force linking us both together now, then the rush of air, far greater than any waterside breeze. Then came the flash of light and the unsettling floral smell. And he was gone. Chapter 3. This destroying the dead with a single touch thing was even more recent than the seeing the dead thing. It had happened once before, the day I left Wexford. I'd found a strange woman in the downstairs bathroom where I'd been stabbed. She too had looked frightened, and I'd reached out, and she too had exploded into nothingness. I'd tried to tell myself that this had been a fluke, something to do with the room itself. The bathroom was where the Ripper had cornered me. The bathroom was where the Terminus had exploded. I'd convinced myself that the room did it. But no, it was me. I walked home, an entirely uphill walk in every way, feeling queasy and shaky. Once there, I went to the conservatory, which was really just a glassed-in porch. I sat with my head resting on my knees and replayed the scene again and again in my head. The inevitable rain came and tapped on the roof, rolling down the panes of glass. The squad. There were a lot of Chaudharis in London, and even quite a few Bhuvana Chaudharis. I knew Boo had been in a serious car accident, but I found nothing about it. Nothing about Boo at all, really. That surprised me. Of the three of them, I expected her to pop up somewhere. But I guess once you joined the squad, your Facebook days were over. I searched for Stephen last. In terms of his past, I knew very little. I think he said once he was from Kent, but Kent was a big place. He went to Eton. He had been on the rowing team while he was there. I started with that and managed to come up with one photo of a rowing team in which I could clearly see him in the back. He was one of the tallest, with dark hair and eyes fixed at the camera. He was one of the not smiling ones. In fact, he was the least smiling person in the photo. Like everyone else, he had his arms folded over his chest. But he seemed to mean it. But again, there was nothing in terms of how to make contact. I stared at the photo of Stephen for a long time, then at the ceiling of the conservatory, which was thick with condensation and fat drops of water. I knew that Stephen and Callum shared a flat on a small street in London called Goodwin's Court. I'd been there. I had never, however, looked at the building number. It sounded funny.
"You look funny," I replied.
I could hear Wexford noises in the background. Not that Wexford noises were so particular, it was just noise. People, voices, guys' voices. He was talking quickly, telling me a story about some guy in his building who'd been busted for claiming to have an interview at a university, but actually he went off to see his girlfriend in Spain, and how someone had ratted him out to Jerome, and Jerome had the unwelcome task of reporting him, or something. I was only half listening. I rubbed at my legs and stared at the images of Goodwin's Court. I hadn't shaved in 3 weeks, so that was quite a situation I had going. For the first few days, I hadn't been able to bend over completely or get the injured area wet, so I couldn't shave. The hairs sprouted, and they were kind of cute. So I just let them go to see what would happen. And what had happened was that I had a fine web of delicate hair all over my legs that I could ruffle while I watched television, like some people absently pet their cats. I was my very own fuzzy pet. The grainy picture told me nothing.
Hello,
Jerome said. I'm listening, I lied. I guess the story had finished.
I have to go, he said. You're disgusting. I want you to know that.
Clever. So I called, and Zuoko Graphics answered. Well, some woman did, not the entire agency. Hi, I said. I'm trying to reach out to someone else in this building. It's kind of an emergency. Sorry to bug you, but there are some guys who live upstairs from you.
Two guys, right? The woman said. About 19 or 20?
That's them, I said. They moved out about a week and a half ago.
Oh, you said it's an emergency. Do you have another way of reaching them, or...
It's okay, I said. Thanks. So that was that. I struck that off the list. They'd moved out. Because of me? Because I knew where they lived? Maybe they were really cleaning up their tracks so they could never be found again. I heard someone come into the house. I quickly clicked on a link to BBC News and pretended to be deeply engrossed in world affairs. My mom came into the kitchen.
We have chairs, she said. I like it down here. It's where I belong.
Doing some work? She asked.
My parents weren't stupid. They knew I hadn't really been keeping up with school stuff, but they hadn't been pressuring me. I was recovering. Everyone was gentle with me. Soft voices, food on demand, command of the remote control. But there was just a little lilt of hope in her voice, and I hated to disappoint her.
Yep, I lied. I just got a call from Julia. She's asking all of us to come in tomorrow for a group session. Is that all right with you?
I ran my thumbs along the bottom edge of my computer. This wasn't right. We didn't do group sessions. Was this an intervention? It sounded like an intervention, at least like the ones I had seen on TV. They get your family and a psychologist, and they sit you in a room and tell you that the game is up. You have to change. Change or die. Except I didn't drink or do drugs, so I wasn't sure what they could intervene about.
You can't stop someone from doing nothing all the time.
I thought about the man again, my hand reaching out in greeting, maybe the first greeting he'd had in years, the hand that wiped him from existence, or something.
Sure, I said, slightly dazed. Whatever.
The next day at noon, the three of us waited by Julia's door, staring down at the little smoke detector-shaped noise reduction devices that lined the hallway. That's how you could tell a therapist was behind the door. One of these little privacy devices would spring up next. This all was. If there is one thing that could sway my parents, it was a professional opinion. An expert witness. They both dealt with them all the time, and they knew how to take that knowledge and advice. Julia was a professional, and she said this was what I needed. They were still listening.
I've been in touch with them, she went on. There are new security measures in place. They have a new system that apparently cost £500,000.
They should have had that before, my dad said.
It's best to think forward, Julia said gently, not backward. The system includes biometric entry pads and 40 new CCTV cameras feeding into a constantly monitored station. Curfew hours have been changed, and the police now include Wexford on a patrol, simply because of all the publicity. The reality is that it is probably the most secure environment she could be in right now. The school term is only going to last about 2 more weeks. This short period would allow her to reintegrate herself. It's an excellent trial run to get Rory back into a more normal routine. Oh, the silence in that room. The silence of 1,000 silences. I could hear that stupid clock ticking away.
Do you really feel ready?
my mom asked me. Don't let anyone talk you into feeling like you're ready.
It wasn't phrased as a question. I think it was more of an invitation. They wanted me to say I wasn't ready, and we would just go on like this, safe and secure and static.
This was happening. They were saying yes. Yes, I could go back. No, they didn't want me to, and yes, it went against every instinct they had.
And possibly against every instinct I had.